Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It is the beginning of another week here on the Council of Trent. I am, of course, your host, Catholic apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. I hope you had a good weekend. I hope you adjusted to the little bit of time traveling you did. I know I'm trying to. My wife and her sister joked about the cruelty of the person who, within the span of a week, placed Halloween and Fall Back right next to each other in the calendar. Riddle me this. What person doesn't understand what time they're supposed to go to bed, what time they get up, even though the clocks go back, doesn't handle well staying up and eating a bunch of candy, and just when they've gotten off their candy binge, their biological clocks get thrown off by Fall Back? The answer? A toddler. And all of our toddlers are dealing with this. I myself am. Now, I had a little bit of a break. When we had Fall Back yesterday, I was in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I had just finished a speaking tour there. I was at Bishop Dwenger High School and St. Vincent de Paul Parish speaking to groups there. Wonderful people. Great Catholic school there, by the way. Those students were, if you've ever been in a high school, trying to keep one high schooler's attention can be a challenge. Keeping 1,000 of them, their attention can be quite the challenge, and yet they were very engrossed in the presentation I gave on relativism. We had a packed house at St. Vincent de Paul Parish for my talk on how to talk about tough moral issues. Once the talk was done, got back to my hotel late. I had an early 6:30 a.m. flight leaving Fort Wayne, going to Chicago, and back on home here to San Diego. And thankfully, so I love Fall Back because, you know, I get to that little extra hour of sleep. That's fine when you're just an adult. But what's hard is that children, small children, toddlers, they don't get that. They don't get that. So they just wake up right when they darn well feel like waking up and throw everything else off. And I've been thrown off a little bit with their schedule as well. So do bear with me. But I appreciate your guys' prayers as making the podcast possible and your donations that are really helping us grow. And if you'd like to become a premium subscriber, we'll have some premium content this week for you. Don't have it just yet. I'm working with our technical group here to get some really good goodies for you. If you thought you had fun goodies on Halloween, we'll have some good extras for our premium subscribers this week. If you're interested in that, consider making a donation at trenthornpodcast.com. And it is making a difference. We're on the cusp of expanding the podcast. When I was in Fort Wayne, Indiana, I got the chance to speak with a representative from Catholic Radio when I was there. And so we were in talks with representatives of local Catholic radio stations who have an interest in carrying the Council of Trent as a possibly a show that will come on once a week, or if there's room in the schedule, it could be a daily radio show to reach the masses. And that would make me very happy. That should make you very happy that your support, whether you're a premium subscriber or you have liked the podcast, you've recommended it to others, it really is paying off to reach a lot of people. And so for that, I am, of course, eternally grateful. So now I'm back in here, and during my talk at St. Vincent de Paul Parish during the Q&A session, we covered a wide variety of issues. One gentleman brought up something that I've been hearing more and more in my talks people want to know about, and that's the issue of Islam. How do you take our faith, and then how do you communicate it and share it to someone who is a Muslim? And this can be difficult for a lot of people because Islam is still a fairly minority religion here in the United States. Most people don't personally know someone who practices Islam. I mean, I've only really lived in major cities, so I've always known where there's a mosque nearby, things that are happening. There was actually a mosque where there was always a lot of activities by our Catholic Newman Center at Arizona State University. I remember walking by and, you know, seeing that. But otherwise, most of my knowledge of Islam comes from my personal study of that and other religions. But people more and more are coming to have interactions with people, whether it's online through social media or in person, about Islam, wondering how to share and evangelize our faith. And I'll probably have other episodes in the future that break down how to evangelize Muslims and what to look out for in discussions with them about, you know, where do we agree and then where do we disagree, sometimes vehemently disagree, and how can we have good conversations on that. But I wanted to point out to you today, good listener, that if you want to talk about Islam in our modern culture, you have to be very careful. I mean, it goes without saying that there have been people, you look at the Charlie Hebdo shootings 3 years ago at a French magazine that dared to lampoon Islam, and they reaped the wrath of Muslim fundamentalists who violently retaliated against them for that action. That's something that lots of people worry about. Even my own wife has said to me, hey, be careful if you're going to criticize Islam. You know, there are people who will act violently in that regard. And some people say that that's exaggerated. But there's a weird two-pronged element that comes into play when we're talking about criticism of Islam. First, there is the violent reaction from Muslim extremists. And then there is the reaction from individuals, secular liberals, ironically enough, who are always quick to rush to the defense of Islam. And I'm not sure why this is. I believe this usually happens out of a misplaced sense of empathy and concern for racial persecution, you know, a concern for disenfranchised minorities. But ironically enough, when secular liberalism comes to the defense of Islam, even radical Islam, even Muslims who promote violence and the restriction of other people's liberties in the name of promoting Islam, that secular liberals will come to their defense. A lot of times I feel like that's kind of a racist thing to do. And it really boils down to this, that people who are not very religious, they don't like Christianity. They say Christianity is part of an oppressive patriarchal system. You've ever heard of a WASP? W-A-S-P, not the little insect. A WASP, for many secular liberals, is the worst thing that you can be. You're the stereotypical oppressor if you are a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. When I was going to Arizona State University, I had a law professor who said to me once, I think WASP is actually kind of redundant. You know, white and Anglo-Saxon is kind of the same thing. I like to say those people are ASPs, A-S-P. He was a law professor, but I was taking a history of law class for my bachelor's degree in history at ASU. And I pointed out to the professor, I said, Professor, isn't an ASP, A-S-P, an ASP a venomous kind of snake? And he just looked at me and he curled his lips and he smiled. Indeed it is, Mr. Horn. Indeed it is. So on the one hand, Christianity is considered to be, you know, this violent, oppressive religion, whereas Islam, we're always told Islam, oh, it's a religion of peace. Islam means peace. No, Islam comes from an Arabic word that means more submission, as in the peace that you get by just giving up, essentially. Now, there's nothing wrong with submission to God. There's that wonderful book, I forget who wrote it, but it was Trustful Surrender to Divine Providence. Now, that's an important element of our faith as well, that we have to give ourselves over to divine providence and trust in God's will for our lives. So I have nothing against the Muslim belief that one ought to submit your whole self to the will of God or the will of Allah. In Islam, Allah is just their word for God. But the problem becomes when people are told that even if you are not Muslim, you have to play by the rules of Islam or else. And secular liberal allies will come in to defend them. And it's a lot of times that it's racist because there's this sense, well, we have to, Christianity, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, they are the oppressors. We have to stand up for minorities who are oppressed. And so it leads to this racist generalization that goes like this. Well, all Arabs are Muslims, and all Muslims are Arabs. And that is not true. Those two are not identical. For there are many Arabs who are not Muslim. I live here in the studio we're broadcasting in is in El Cajon, California, where there's a very large community of Chaldean Christians, you know, who come from Ur of the Chaldees, where Abraham came from, in Iraq. They fled Iraq in the 1980s and resettled here. Lots and lots of Arabic Christians now have dwindled in numbers over the years, for sure, but still a sizable number in the Middle East trying to keep this ancient faith alive amidst persecution from groups like Al-Qaeda. Or in Africa, you have groups like Boko Haram, who are kidnapping Christian girls, you know, killing Christian boys and kidnapping Christian girls and selling them into sex slavery. And nobody wants to talk about that because criticism of Islam is essentially considered among secular liberals criticism of brown people. And you know, you can't target these oppressed minorities. Well, that's racist because just as not all Arabs are Muslim, not all Muslims are Arab. In fact, the largest number of Muslims you'll find in the world are in Southeast Asia, in countries like Malaysia, not in the Middle East. You can find Arabs, you can find people who practice Islam across all different kinds of races. I think the well, I'm going to see if this is right. I'm pretty sure that the Boston, well, maybe it was the Boston Marathon Bombers. They were white. I'll have to look this up later to see if they were Muslim or not. So I'm not going to quote on that right now. But I was just reading a case, the Everybody Draw Muhammad case. You've probably heard of that a while back. That was when South Park back in 2010 depicted Muhammad. This wasn't the first time they had done that. And so they depicted Muhammad and they received death threats as a result. And one of those death threats came from a Muslim named Zachary Adam Chesser, who was eventually arrested by the U.S. He's, if you look it up, he's Caucasian, appears to be white. And he was later arrested for aiding al-Shabaab, which is a group that is aligned with al-Qaeda. So I bring this up because in the news recently, you might have heard about this. A European court has rejected the claim that a woman who criticized Islam, who criticized Muhammad, she said, you know, she was holding seminars in Austria, and then she was indicted for essentially for criticizing religion, for hurting religious people's feelings. I'm not making that up. That's the essence of the charge, is hurting the religious feelings of others without just cause. And so I want you to listen. This is how the Associated Press puts it. The Strasbourg-based European Court of Human Rights ruled Thursday that Austrian courts had carefully balanced this woman's right to freedom of expression with the right of others to have their religious feelings protected. And this was related to her calling the prophet of Islam, a pedophile. The woman in her late 40s, identified only as ES, claimed during two public seminars in 2009 that the Prophet Muhammad's marriage to a young girl was akin to pedophilia. A Vienna court convicted her in 2011 of disparaging religious doctrines, ordering her to pay a 480 euro or $547 fine plus costs. The ruling was later upheld by the Austrian Appeals Court. The ECHR said the Austrian court's decision served the legitimate aim of preserving religious peace. So if you haven't done so yet, you might want to thank our founding fathers for giving us such a strong and robust First Amendment of the Constitution that simply says, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, prohibiting the free exercise thereof, that Congress shall not abridge the freedom of speech. That is it. Now, later on, the Supreme Court had said, the only thing you can't do is use freedom of speech to shout fire falsely. There really is a fire, you can shout fire. You can't shout fire falsely in a crowded theater. And you can't, and I've said this on the podcast before, you can't tell a rioting mob, hey, everybody, go and lynch that guy. You can't imminently incite violence. But everything else in U.S. constitutional law is fair game, thankfully protected by the freedom of speech we have in the First Amendment. Very rare. Most other countries don't have that. So if you, my friends who are in Canada, who will try to defend the unborn, defend the conjugal nature of marriage, that marriage is a union of one man and one woman, it's hard. You get brought up to the Human Rights Court all the time is threatened because in Canada, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms does not give a blanket protection of freedom of speech. Similar to the European Court of Human Rights, freedom of speech is one freedom. Well, you're allowed to say what you want, as long as it doesn't offend other people's sensibilities or cause harm to other people. And my wife was actually reading in Coddling of the American Mind, the book I've recommended here on the show numerous times by Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff. She was reading in there that millennials are not actually opposed to free speech. In general, millennials believe in freedom of speech, even speech that might be called hate speech. It's the ones right after us. It's the people that I call the tweens. So these are the people who never, for them, 9/11 might as well be Pearl Harbor and dial-up internet might as well be the telegraph. They're completely detached from those elements of the past. They have been raised in a hypersensitive bubble where if I thought everybody got a participation medal, everybody there got a Celebrate Diversity participation trophy among the tweens. These are the people who were born, if I had to put my finger on it, if you were born after the year 2000, if you were born after 1995, probably 1995 is a good cutoff, you were a tween. And so you don't remember 9/11. At least you barely remember. You might have been four when it happened. And you have been raised in a very hypersensitive bubble and have been inundated with technology since you were able to scroll your finger across an iPad. And that's led to the tweens being they're just extremely sensitive. And I've seen this in my interactions now with high school students, where I used to make you know, just a joke, a regular joke I might tell about something that flew 10 years ago, now does not. So you have people, a growing generation, thinking that freedom of speech does not apply to speech that hurts the feelings of other people. And that is what we see in this decision about Islam from the European Court of Human Rights. A good article in The Atlantic talks about this more. So notice that, you know, the Associated Press, when they talk about it, make it seem like this woman just called Muhammad a pedophile and that she's just this hateful woman. And so the Associated Press says, the woman, you know, claimed in public seminars that the Prophet Muhammad's marriage to a young girl was akin to pedophilia, in quotation marks. That's kind of a vague way to talk about the story to make it seem like she's just attacking the Prophet for no basis to it. Graham Wood's article in The Atlantic on October 27th, entitled "In Europe, Speech is an Alienable Right," gets down to the issue, gets way more down to brass tacks. Because here's what happened. The woman pointed out, she said, look, Muhammad was married to his third wife, Aisha, when she was 6 years old, and he consummated the marriage when she was 9 years old. And these are public facts. Muslims do not dispute these facts whatsoever. It's not disputed. And she brought this up and said this would make him a pedophile. And the reasoning from the ECHR boggles the mind. Here is a paragraph. This is what the European Court of Human Rights says, why her description of a man who marries a six-year-old, consummates that marriage with when she's 9 years old, says this person's a pedophile, why that is not legitimate free speech, but it's basically hateful rhetoric that can't be tolerated. This is what the court said. By accusing Muhammad of pedophilia, ES, the woman, had merely sought to defame him, without providing evidence that his primary sexual interest in Aisha had been her not yet having reached puberty, or that his other wives or concubines had been similarly young. In particular, ES had disregarded the fact that the marriage with Aisha had continued until the Prophet's death, when she had already turned 18 and had therefore passed the age of puberty. So if you didn't catch that in this excerpt of the court's ruling, ECHR, this woman was out of bounds to call Muhammad a pedophile because he was married to other adult women and he stayed married to Aisha after she entered puberty. Even though this man had sex with a 9-year-old girl, well, you can't say he's a pedophile because of this technicality. Unbelievable. I wonder in Europe, do you think there's a lot of people who call a Catholic priest who engages in sexual relations with teenagers, in most cases here in the U.S. and abroad, Catholic sexual abuse among clerics is not even technically pedophilia. You have Catholic clerics engaging in 80% of the time sexual relations with boys who are over the age of puberty, over the age of 10, 11, or 12. And there is actually a word for this. It's called ahebophilia, not pedophilia. It's attraction to minors who are post-pubescent. But I'm sure, you bet there's a lot of people in Europe who call priests, say Catholic priests who have done this, pedophiles. Do you think that they're brought up by the ECHR? I highly doubt it, even though that's even not factually correct. The other night, my wife and I were watching on YouTube. Sometimes I get in these nostalgic moods. There's a television show I enjoyed back in the early 2000s. You know, it's To Catch a Predator. Did you ever see that Chris Hansen, MSNBC's, or NBC aired it, then MSNBC did the reruns. To Catch a Predator is with Chris Hansen. He goes out with a decoy with Perverted Justice, this online watchdog group, and they try to find men online who want to have sexual relations with underage girls. And so they send out these decoys and the guys show up, the camera crew is there, the police are there. And, you know, it is, I hate to say it, you know, I obviously you should pray for everyone, including those who would commit these gross, awful crimes for the conversion of their souls. But a part of you does like seeing these sex offenders getting their comeuppance. So the idea, though, that someone's not a pedophile if they're married to an adult or they've had relations with adults. Many pedophiles in the United States who are arrested, many men who are arrested for pedophilia are married to adult women. In fact, they marry grown women, have sexual relations with them, so they can have access to younger children. They may not even be exclusively attracted to prepubescent children, but they still do that and we still call them a pedophile, and no court is going to say that that's defamation or libel or slander. The only verbal semantics, incredible philosophical gymnastics you have to do to say someone who consummates a marriage with someone who's 9 years old is not a pedophile under these terms, you find with Islam, with these secular liberal allies coming in here. Now, when we talk about the issue of Islam, though, with our Muslim brothers and sisters, I don't think that this is the first tack that we should go on to talk about. I think it's an important historical fact to recognize and to talk about, but I don't think that it's the best way to go through because, now, I think, though, that consummating a marriage, marrying a six-year-old, consummating with a nine-year-old is very different, because here's the objection that will be raised. Historically, even within the Catholic Church, the age of consent during that time was very low. You didn't really have a formal age of consent until the 12th century. Gratian was the first person to assemble a code of canon law in the church's history, at least the first comprehensive code. It set the age of consent at 12 years old for marriage, for sexual relations. And so throughout history, both in the medieval period and the ancient world, there was essentially, you were a child, then when you hit puberty, you were an adult. And there was no in-between. Adolescence is something that was invented like 100 years ago. In the ancient world, you were either a child or then once you hit puberty, you were considered an adult. And puberty for most girls at that time probably was around 12 years old. So I think even if Muhammad married someone who was 9, I can't imagine a 9-year-old in medieval Arabic society having entered puberty yet. So the Catholic Church even today allows for marriage at the ages of 14 for girls and 16 for boys. But if that is below the age of consent, within that country, you have to abide by the laws of the country that you're in. You'd have to seek the approval of your bishop. So I mention that because, you know, you don't want to take one element of a religion, focus on or that historical part of an individual's life, and you should be prepared to hear the counter responses that will come back. So, and that's one that could come back, but I think that they're very different cases. Now, I do think it's important to bring up because this court case, what amazes me is this person was pointing out just a fact about Islam. It's not a great fact, but it's not something that you want to trumpet around the world, but she's pointing this out and she is censored and arrested. Why? Because it hurts religious feelings. That is what the ECH included in their justification, that you have to balance freedom of expression with other people's religious feelings. And that's what we're seeing growing more and more here in the United States, especially among college campuses, where people say that they are triggered by hate speech and that some ideas are so awful or so triggering that they are essentially acts of violence that have to be prohibited. And it's a dangerous road if we go down that. And that is one we're seeing right now with Islam. But there's also a reverse here that to keep in mind that if you say things that are considered blasphemy in Muslim countries, be prepared for a violent response if it's a Muslim-majority country. You may have heard about this. If not, I think it's important for you to know about. There is a Christian woman in Pakistan who was cleared of blasphemy charges, but her life is still in danger. This is from CBS News. The husband of a Christian woman acquitted 8 years after being sentenced to death for blasphemy, but not released after countrywide protests, appealed on Sunday to U.S. President Donald Trump and British Prime Minister Theresa May to help the family leave Pakistan. Asia Bibi's husband, Ashiq Masih, in a brief video message, said they were in danger in Pakistan. So he says that they live under an increased sense of fear. Here's what happened. So several years ago, back in 2009, Asia Bibi had an argument with two other farm workers, two other women who are Muslim. And Bibi is a Christian. And a few days later, those women said that she had insulted Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. And then a mob gathered saying that she needed to be beheaded, she needed to be executed for insulting Islam. And so then she was arrested, tried for blasphemy. She was sentenced to death, and she's been on death row for 8 years. And finally, Pakistani Supreme Court overturned her conviction. So she's not on death row anymore. But here's the thing. She has been forbidden from leaving the country. So what this is that the state the country, their courts realize, well, we don't have enough evidence here to convict her of blasphemy. The charges are too weak. We can't do that. It's overturned. But they have to appease the hardline Muslim factions in the country. And what they're doing is they're throwing her to the wolves. The article says that Bibi's lawyer, Saiful Maluk, has already fled the country for safety. So her own lawyer is gone. And she needs to get out of the country of Pakistan, because sooner or later, one of these mobs is going to find her and they're going to dispense mob justice, because there was outrage and protests about the fact that her conviction had been overturned. And so this is what happens. This is a common thing, a strategy or a pattern in Islam, that Islam begins in a country when it's a minority religion. It seeks tolerance and it seeks legal protection for its beliefs to the point where that it is illegal for other people to criticize Islam. It's illegal for other people to do it, that because it hurts religious feelings, it offends a disenfranchised minority. But then once Muslim majority control is engaged, then there are blasphemy laws, then there are laws that prohibit proselytizing, evangelizing others in the Christian faith, apostatizing, laws that prevent you from leaving Islam under the penalty of death. So that is what we're up against. And that's why, as Christians, we must be aware of Islam, and we're not the people who have to use violence in response to violence. We should be prepared to give a witness to our faith, to our Muslim brothers and sisters. I'll actually be including some of that in my new book, The Counterfeit Christs, because I talk about Jesus in the Quran. So I talk about Jesus in the Quran and, you know, what he is like, and how he's called the Prophet Isa, and how he's different than the real Jesus, and how to respond to that. So, well, we're coming to the end of our time together, so I'll make you a deal. I'm going to do a special short bonus podcast on three things to remember when you're evangelizing Muslims. What is some of the important points to remember? So for our premium subscribers, I'll extend our discussion a little bit more this week. If you're not a premium subscriber yet, I hope that you will go log on this week to be able to check that out. For as little as $5 donation, you get access to that bonus episode I just talked about, how to understand the Jesus of Islam and how to make an apologetic response, as well as other bonus episodes we'll be bringing you, and you help the podcast reach so many more people. That is at trenthornpodcast.com. Again, I am grateful for your guys' support. Do pray for our brothers and sisters in Christ who live in Muslim-majority countries, who are in the Middle East and other countries, who are sharing the faith and witnessing the faith and are risking martyrdom in doing that. So I hope that you will join me in praying for them, praying for Asia Bibi, this Christian woman in Pakistan, that she will be delivered from this persecution that she is facing, and that other people there will be able to speak out. I was actually in Perth, Australia, not too long ago, and this made me feel how international my mission has become. I'm sitting in Perth, Australia at an internet cafe looking at my emails, and a seminarian said, "I'm a Pakistani seminarian, and your work, Mr. Horn, has really helped me to spread the faith with everyone, including my Muslim brothers and sisters, and I am forever grateful for it." And I thought he was a Pakistani, someone who was in America going to seminary, who was maybe born in Pakistan or his parents are from Pakistan. I checked the IP address of where he sent the email, which I can trace, by the way, for those people who like to send me threats and hate mail. I know where you're sending your emails from. And so I looked at his IP address where the email came from, and it was from Islamabad, Pakistan. He wrote this to me, and he's spreading the faith there in a country where you can be put to death for doing anything that seems to run contrary to Islam or is blasphemous. So when we think we have it hard here and we share the faith, let's offer a prayer up for our brothers and sisters who are risking death and persecution from atheistic totalitarian regimes, from theocratic Muslim regimes. The only thing we have to risk in this country is usually like a sense of embarrassment. And I think the grace of God can help us get through that. And I hope he helps us get through the rest of the week. And I hope he helps you to have a blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trenthornpodcast.com.